Hello and welcome to Ag PhD Radio. I'm Darren Hefty.
And I'm Brian Hefty. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to talk a little about milo and sorghum production on today's show. If you've got any questions for us, you can certainly give us a call here, 844-44-AG-PHD. That's 844-442-4743. You can also email us, radio@agphd.com. And I would say, too, if you don't have milo, you're not raising any grain sorghum on your farm, there are still a lot of the things we're going to talk about today that apply to just about every crop. And corn is a very similar crop to milo. So a lot of the things we're going to talk about, it will pertain directly to corn. All right, we are going to get to the Ag PhD mailbag here in just a second. I would just say, before we get going today, it's not far from prepay season, and I'm going to assume you've been talking to your seed supplier, your crop protection supplier about prepay for the next year. I guess I would just really encourage you, make sure that you're doing your homework and asking good questions before that. We'll probably talk about prepay here a little more over the next few weeks, but I've been getting lots of questions from farmers about some of these new traits that have been coming out, just some of the lower prices we're seeing right now on corn seed, soybean seed, fertilizer, crop protection products. I mean, there's a lot of good news out there, plus commodity prices have been trending up. So hopefully things will turn out great for your farm here over the next year, but it certainly pays to plan ahead a little bit. All right, let's get to the Ag PhD mailbag.
It's now mailbag time with Brian and Darren. All right, I'm going to start you off with a huge stack of soil samples,
good
Brent.
Grief.
It's always a good way to start your day, right? No, actually, we love getting soil samples. It really does help us as we're trying to diagnose what's going on in fields, what we can do to get a better return.
Yeah, and before Darren asked the question here, I would just say he literally handed me, I'm going to say it looks like about, I don't know, 30, 40 soil tests. Fortunately, it's on four pages, but The point is, part of the reason why we do it that way, rather than, oh, I've spent half a day prepping to answer this question or anything, is because it really doesn't take half a day. And I think a lot of people look at soil tests and they're like, oh my gosh, I'm lost. There's nothing I can do here. There are really just a few basic keys to look for, and we talk about these quite often. So if you do have any questions for us, just let us know. It's not that difficult, and we would encourage you, learn more about soil testing and just reading a soil test, because when you know the answers to that, you're going to be able to better invest your fertilizer dollars, and that's what it's all about. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
All right, so this is from Brandon, and he said, I've got some questions for you on ammonium sulfate use in soybeans. Now, he said, I've got west samples and east samples. The east was corn this year, so that's going to be west, or that's going to be my soybeans next year, so the east half. And he said, 2 years ago.
Wait, stop. Where does it say east and west somewhere on here? I don't see east and west on here anywhere.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't see east and west at all. But anyway, go ahead.
All right,
go ahead.
So he's putting on yield goals, 80 bushel beans.
Okay.
He's been getting 75 bushel the last couple of years.
Okay.
So he said he put down a 30, 47, 100 with 14 pounds of sulfur as well. Was hoping to put on even more potash, trying to build the K levels, still working on his dad to get along with that program. And anyway, he said we had applied some pre-plant AMS in 2019 and 2020. We top-dressed AMS right before full canopy.
Okay.
Yields were fairly similar either way, but of course it's two different years. And he said, I believe that I had heard from Perry Galloway at your field day that the best time to apply the AMS would be right before full canopy in soybeans. Wondering if that's true for us here in South Central Minnesota as well, as it would be for the guys in Arkansas.
No, it probably is not. So say that again. When did he say exactly when to apply it?
Right before full canopy.
Right. And the reason why I say that is it might be right, but it might not be right, because it all depends on when you reach what you call full canopy. And don't forget, when you start talking down south, for some farmer in Arkansas, they have way more heat and they have way more moisture. So they might get their beans to a much bigger stage before we do. So I'd say this. A lot of times, I don't feel like we've reached canopy until we're at R2, R3, maybe even R4 some years. Well, I want lots of nitrogen there, definitely by R3. So it can take in the range of 30 to 60 days for that ammonium sulfate to break down and come available for your crop. So I'm not going to wait clear until R2 to apply it, and then I would like to have it available in a week or two. That's not quite going to cut it. So if it was me, I would think more about the calendar than I would think about crop canopy. So I would consider applying it, let's say, sometime early June maybe. So if you do that, you're probably in pretty good shape.
All right.
Oh, did we have no. You gave me all the soil tests and all the buildup, and then I didn't have
any. Ammonium sulfate was the big question there.
Okay,
he wants to get more K out there, but he said he's trying to get his dad on board with that program.
Okay, so he said 75 bushel beans. Now that's, don't forget, when we start talking about yields,
average.
That's exactly right. That's the average, which means if he's averaging 75, he has to have spots that are 90, right? And probably quite a few spots. So I want to talk about the 90 real quick. K2O potassium, you're removing 108 pounds. 108. And what did you just say? His ratio here, or his fertilizer he's putting out, 30, 47, 100. Okay, so, I mean, he's staying even. And his soil tests are all really low. I mean, like in the ones and twos for K, that's too low. So, yeah, you got to work on more of a build program. And then even on the phosphorus, the 47 isn't bad, but you're gonna run through 66 pounds of phosphate when you have 90 bushel beans just for the grain removal, not even figuring the Stover, just the grain removal. So what I'm saying here is, 30, 47, 100 for beans sounds good because a lot of people don't do anything, but you're still on the good spots falling behind. So that would be how I would approach it to your dad or whoever you're working with, just so they can understand, okay, well, this is why I want to go more, because we're actually not even putting out as much as we're removing. All right, we are going to talk today about milo and grain sorghum production right after this on Ag PhD Radio.
Maintaining your crops is as important now as it's ever been. Howler, a revolutionary fungicide from AgBiome, can help. It provides long-lasting protection from a broad spectrum of foliar and soil diseases that affect crops. Howler is OMRI listed, has multiple modes of action, and has minimal pre-harvest and re-entry intervals. It's flexible, easy to use, and is available right now. Visit agbiome.com/howler to learn more.
Acre to acre, year to year, generation to generation, nobody scrutinizes performance like you do. And acre to acre, year to year, generation to generation, the consistent performance of Vasgro brand soybeans helps to keep your profitability out in front, offering leading agronomic expertise and 100% exclusive genetics for strong yield potential. Ask your dealer how much further you can grow when Vasgro leads the way. Always read and follow grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
You need a powerful herbicide to fight the war on weeds. Vellum is Rotam North America's mesotrione herbicide, and it fights against the annual broadleaf weeds attacking your cornfields. Winning this battle means higher yields, lower cost to you, and maximized profitability. For long-lasting residual weed control, check out Evinco Vilify and our newest mix, Rixa. For application, flexibility, and season-long control, that's Evinco Vilify and Rixa, powered by Vellum. For more information, visit vellumherbicide.com. That's B-E-L-L-U-M herbicide.com.
Your soybeans are in the bin, but the game isn't over yet. Score more points this year by taking your beans to the end zone. If your beans went in the bin at low moisture, you can naturally rehydrate to reclaim lost yield with the End Zone Fan Control System from Farm Shop MFG. At $10 beans, every point of moisture below your target takes away 15 cents per bushel. That means raising 9% moisture beans to 13 can increase your profits by 60 cents per bushel. Score more yields in the end zone from Farm Shop MFG.
Back, you're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. We're taking your calls and agronomic questions all throughout the show at 844-44-AG-PHD. You can also send us an email, radio@agphd.com, or find us on Twitter, AgPHD Media, Brian Hefty, or Darren Hefty. Today we're talking about Milo or sorghum production, and you're going to find many useful tips here that will work in other crops as well. We'll start off down in Kansas. We've got Jeff, who is a Milo or sorghum grower. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me here today.
All right, when we think about Milo or sorghum, for me, I think about, wow, that is a tough crop that can get by in some pretty dry and difficult environments. That's pretty cool. But, man, it looks like it's got a good profit opportunity going into 2021 as well.
Oh, definitely. We're looking at super strong basis this year. The Chinese are really wanting this crop, and that's driven our basis numbers well above corn. And you start having comparable yields, then it and lower cost of production, it kind of becomes obvious which crop is more attractive.
I was just talking to a grower in southern Nebraska today about the same thing, that, wow, I can get by with a little less on production costs than I can with corn, and I've got this opportunity to market. How long is that opportunity going to be around? Is that something that you're contracting for your own farm right now?
Yeah, that's a good question to know how long it's going to be around. I've already contracted some, but we're still harvesting, and we've got still some unknown on how many bushels are left out here, and I would really like to get something locked up, you know, finished up here before something might take it away. You know, market can change pretty quick.
Absolutely.
Seems like when you're depending on another country like China, you just don't know what's going to happen, when they might just quit. So
yeah.
It'd be good to really consider locking it in, but you know, we don't know. We don't have a crystal ball to know how long it's going to be there.
As far as yields go in your part of Kansas, what are they like? How do they range on sorghum? Do they move a lot from year to year, or are they a lot more stable than some of the other crops?
They are quite a bit more stable than any other fall, what I'd say, dry land crop. That's where we tend to have a lot of sorghum acres, is on our dry land acres, because, as you mentioned before, it's so extremely tough. Our region of Kansas, you know, it varies from one side of the state to the other, but you can typically depend on 100 bushel Milo in our area if you manage it with maybe some wheat stubble rotation. You got years that you might hit 140, and then you got other years that, you know, might be 70 or 80, but it's been pretty stable 100 bushel, you know, average, I would say, in our area.
Yeah, the stability is something that we hear a lot about, that we have a lot better bottom end protection with that particular crop than others. That's a really good thing, and I love hearing that exports are up. And I know sorghum gets used for a lot of things. Do you have a big local market there in terms of ethanol or a feed market?
There are some end users in our area. Of course, ethanol is a big user of sorghum. You know, the swine industry in our area uses it heavily. I know other areas, you know, poultry might be, not necessarily in our areas, but poultry demands it. And there is some cattle that use it too. Those are the main top ones. And there is some food grade too demand in our area.
Now, you mentioned putting it on wheat stubble. Is that's your preferred rotation?
Yeah, I think the best rotation that I've seen in dry land is wheat, milo, fallow rotation. Just going into wheat stubble, you know, it insulates the ground so well, and it holds the moisture so well. And if you've got any kind of moisture profile, it seems like you can weather some pretty long stretches of dry weather and still make a decent milo crop.
Yeah, we had a tough dry stretch here, and our Milo turned out really well this year. It's an interesting crop to raise, no doubt about it. We're talking with Jeff down in Kansas.
Yeah, I think you look at the dry period that we had, you know, rain shut off in early August for us, and things looked, the Milo looked really good. We had really good yield potential. We probably dropped 20 a bushel just in yield just from that dry, hot streak afterwards. But, you know, I compare that to some other crops, and we would have lost a whole lot more with other crops with that long dry streak that we had.
Yep, I totally agree. We're talking with Jeff down in Kansas about milo or sorghum production. Jeff, thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on here. Good luck as you finish up and get all the crops in.
Thank you. Had a good time. Appreciate you having me on.
You bet. Thanks. We've got Danny Titus with us right now. He's with AgriLiquid, covers the Kansas-Colorado territory there. Danny, how you doing today?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good, good. Okay, so Jeff had mentioned one of the things he likes about raising sorghum is he doesn't have quite as much input cost as he's got in corn. And now with these markets where they're at, it's a pretty attractive crop to grow. So I wanted to visit just a little bit about what you might go after for a fertility program if you wanted to be successful raising milo or sorghum.
Okay. Well, out in western Kansas and eastern Colorado, the guys that have been doing very well with sorghum production have really been fertilizing that crop not much different than what they would a corn crop, to be quite honest. So looking at phosphate, looking at nitrogen, you know, zinc, manganese, those type things. And like I said, they're really treating it very similar to corn out in the western half of the state anyway.
You know, we've found zinc to be so beneficial if we can focus on that and get that level of zinc up in the plants. It's responsible for water regulation, and we talk about sorghum being able to tolerate some of those tough conditions and drought conditions better. I think having that zinc right is one of those keys.
Yes, yes it is. And, you know, out west here with our higher pH soils that we have, we do run into situations where we, you know, farmers will run into iron chlorosis problems. And to some cases, not all by any means, but in some cases, they're actually seeing a manganese deficiency rather than an iron deficiency. So in some cases there, you know, if we aren't paying attention to our soil test and taking a look at all of those nutrients that we have available in the soil, we can run into some problems like that.
Yeah, you mentioned some of these micronutrient deficiencies. What do farmers notice in their crops, or what should they be looking for to see if they're suffering from these kind of situations?
Well, you know, it's kind of odd things that you can see in the crop that can be a key as to maybe you're not getting the best utilization of water that, of, you know, soil moisture that you do have. Your crop just doesn't seem like it's really, you know, taking that water up and stuff. That can be one of it right there. With the higher pH soils, you know, it may not be taking phosphate up like what it should be. So one of the places that you can see some deficiencies show up is in standability of that crop. You know, if you're paying attention to your phosphates and paying attention to your micronutrients, the standability of that crop is going to be much better. And where we run into standability problems, a lot of times it will go back to something that we have missed in that fertility program that we haven't paid attention to.
Yeah, free download that we've got is the Ag PhD Crop Nutrient Deficiencies app. It's something that we put together with the folks at AgriLiquid. You can just type in sorghum, and you've got a bunch of crops there to choose from, and then pick the nutrient that you're interested in. Like Danny had mentioned, iron chlorosis and also manganese deficiency. You can pull those up. It'll show you some pictures of what to look for in your sorghum. And if you see something like that, when you flip through those pictures, you'll undoubtedly see, oh, I've seen plants that look like that before. And that gets you on the right page to get your nutrients in balance. Been talking with Danny Titus here with AgriLiquid. Thank you so much, Danny. I really appreciate having you on. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Pentair Hypro 3D nozzles are your premier choice for fungicide applications. Syngenta fungicide application field trials have shown Hypro 3D nozzles provide a yield advantage of up to 10% over other nozzles, maximizing the return on your fungicide investment. Learn more at pentair.com/hypro.
Your soybeans are in the bin, but the game isn't over yet. Score more points this year by taking your beans to the end zone. At $10 beans, every point of moisture below your target takes away 15 cents per bushel. Reclaim that lost yield with the end zone bin system from Farm Shop MFG.
Want to cut production costs without losing yield? Brian Ryberg from Buffalo Lake, Minnesota has done just that. Here's his story.
We began using a soil warrior on our farm fall of 2014. We've seen many benefits from better water infiltration, a lot less hours on equipment, fuel, able to reduce our fertilizer side. So it's really simplified our operation.
See what makes Soil Warrior different and better at SoilWarrior.com.
I need the solve without the sell.
With NK Seeds, I get people I trust who show me where their hybrids and varieties fit in my field without the heavy sell.
So I get solutions that solve my problems from a partner who knows that success matters.
Find your solve at nkseeds.com.
Are you combining around weed patches, waiting for weeds to dry down, or tired of spring burndown failures? Save time, nutrients, and moisture by including a Valor herbicide brand in your fall burndown program. Valor provides excellent residual control of tough weeds, including kochia, marestail, prickly lettuce, dandelion, plus suppression of bromes. Proactive, effective weed resistance management starts in the fall. Get a clean start for your next season with Valor herbicide brands. Always read and follow label directions.
Resistant weeds got you down? Knock out tough-to-kill herbicide-resistant weeds like Palmer Amaranth and Water Hemp with Tough 5EC. Manufactured by Beltrim Crop Protection, Tough 5EC is a selective contact herbicide for post-emergence control of actively growing broadleaf weeds. Add Tough 5EC to your post-emergence tank mix for enhanced control with no concerns about residual or carryover injury. Ask your local retailer about Tough 5EC or visit BeltramUSA.com. Together, we can get tough on weeds. Always read and follow label instructions.
Fill once, plant all day. The Thrive 3D application system from FMC is a revolutionary in-furrow crop protection platform that plants up to 480 acres between refills. The Thrive 3D application system mounts to most major planter brands and can be yours at no cost with the FMC Freedom Pass program. To learn more, call 815-362-7747 today. Always read and follow all label directions.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. If you have an agronomic question or would like to visit about something going on your farm, our phone lines are open at 844-44-AG-PHD. Let's head down to Texas. We got Patrick Wade with us right now with the Texas Grain Sorghum Producers. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to talk to you.
You know, our country has been in these trade battles now for seemingly a long, long time, and some of the markets have been a little tough. Well, they're finally starting to get good. What's happening in some of the trade markets that's making sorghum so attractive right now?
You know, really one of the most exciting things is that it really feels like it's getting back to normal with sorghum, especially going to China. They've been such an important market to us since they first got into buying in 2013. And this phase one agreement is interesting. There's so many components to it and a lot of different ways to evaluate its success. But from the sorghum industry perspective, what we're looking at is that it's normal. China wants the sorghum that we produce. There's a lot of demand for it over there, and economically it works.
All right, so we were talking to Jeff in Kansas a little earlier, a sorghum producer there, and I asked Jeff, I said, so are you locking in right now with these good prices? He goes, well, I locked in a little, but I just don't know how long these good markets are going to stick around. So are you giving us encouragement, Patrick, that we may have a little bit of time here with some good market prices?
We think so, and I know some folks in Texas have held off on locking in necessarily just because they think there's reason for optimism, too. It's an interesting dynamic with how this phase one agreement works, because on one hand, it's a 2-year agreement that's set for some purchase requirements for 2020 and 2021 with nothing really specific beyond that. So on one hand, you can understand, all right, there's no requirements for purchase levels in 2022 or 2023. However, when you look at the sorghum side of things, China's buying, there's some reports that are out from USTR that peg it at about 600, 650 million in sales this year. And we had sales of over $1 billion in 2015. And we're climbing back to those targets now, and prices are starting to reflect some of the levels they reached in the heights of the trade that we had over the last few years with China as well. So I think when you look at where we're at from a sorghum sale perspective, we're just starting to climb back to where we have been and where we have proven rates of success over the last few years. So I'm certainly optimistic, and I think a lot of the domestic factors in China that lead to them needing to import U.S. grain and U.S. sorghum specifically are still persistent and are only going to continue.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. And that's a really good explanation on this phase one agreement here. We got purchase requirements for a couple of years, but here again, we've got a country that can use a lot of sorghum. That's really exciting. Are they buying specific types of sorghum? What are they really looking for?
You know, that's what's interesting here, and also one of the reasons that I'm personally very optimistic, and a lot of us in the industry are as well, is, yeah, they're going to buy the traditional varieties of sorghum that go in well for feeding their ducks and feeding swine as they try to recover from African swine fever and build their hog populations back up. But they're also, one of the main things they use their domestic supply of sorghum for, and some Australian sorghum as well, is the production of this liquor baijiu, which is a grain alcohol that is a traditional staple in China. And it, because of it's the main drink in China, that makes the most consumed spirit in the world. And we've been finishing up a study with the United Sorghum Checkoff Program to really examine what kind of varieties of sorghum work best for baijiu and what kind of varieties add the most sort of aromatic tendencies that they like to use when making baijiu. So right now, about 30% of U.S. sorghum goes to that. But if we can figure out exactly how to grow the kind of sorghum that they like to make baijiu out of, man, I tell you, that can blow up sales there. And I'm thinking we're talking like magnitudes of order more than what goes in now. And that's one of the things we're excited about as far as what varieties they might want to buy in the future.
That's fantastic. So when you look at variety development in sorghum, is that an area in the industry that's growing?
Yeah, it's something certainly that we're investing a lot from a research side of things in. We have a lot of partners who try to invest in as many, you know, new developing technologies as we can and provide our producers with as many options as we can.
That is excellent. We're talking with Patrick Wade with the Texas Grain Sorghum Producers. Patrick, any other things you want to leave our listeners with today?
You know, again, I think we just have a lot of optimism about where this is going. China is an urbanizing country. You know, there are a lot of the people who live in rural areas there are moving to cities like they are here in the United States. However, that leaves a lot of agriculture and grain production that needs to be filled by imports. I think regardless of what you have as far as a managed trade agreement with phase one, we have a great relationship with our buyers in China. We did throughout the whole trade war, too. We weathered that, and we continue to work with them, and we're looking forward to continue to work with them over the next few years.
Great stuff. Thank you so much, Patrick. Really appreciate having you on.
Thank you for talking to me. It's great to talk.
We've got Dan Atkinson on right now from Kansas, farmer there. Also, past chairman of the National Sorghum Producers, so great experience level here. Dan, were you excited listening to Patrick?
Oh, absolutely. I think he hit some very key points of the things that we're really excited about here in as a sorghum farmer.
That's awesome. All right, got a couple of real basic questions for you. We've had a number of our listeners that say, okay, we don't raise Milo in our area, we don't raise sorghum in our area. Talk to us about some of the basic information, how you're planting it, how you're harvesting it, and so forth.
Well, here in northwest Kansas, you know, sorghum has been a very key crop on our farm for many, many years. You know, we need to think of sorghum as a row crop. Anything that's good for other row crops is generally good for sorghum. So, you know, our basic sorghum production method is planted into wheat stubble that's been chem fallowed from the previous year. We're planting it with a row crop planter on 30-inch centers. And in our area where we're in about a 22-inch rainfall area, we're dropping about 40 to 45,000 seeds. And our fertility program is very similar to what people would think of in corn, that 1 to 1.2 pounds of nitrogen per bushel of yield goal.
You fertilize like corn and you kind of harvest it like soybeans?
Similar. Actually, many methods of harvesting sorghum, some of the row crop type heads, are useful. On our farm, we use platform heads just because we can cover broader areas.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. Interesting. All right. So looking into 2021, it looks like sorghum acres are trending upward. Is that accurate in your area too?
I think it will be, especially as we're kind of starting into a drought in this area. I think some producers will back out of some other crops, corn and soybeans, some of those acreages, and kind of go back to a more resilient, tougher crop like sorghum.
All right. So when we look at how tough that crop is, are there some management practices too that you're doing to really help it out when you know you're going to be a little drier?
Yes, I definitely, you know, sorghum and no-till fit really well together, especially in our area. Planting sorghum into heavy residue is always preferable, just from a moisture conservation standpoint. And also, you know, we can drop back our seeding populations or pick a shorter season or shorter stature hybrid so that we can maybe even use even less moisture.
Yeah, I think that's one of the real impressive things, too, the canopy that it creates and just the protection of soil moisture, I think, is really tough to match.
Yeah, and especially from a livestock standpoint, we have cow-calf operation as well. It provides a lot more fodder for winter livestock grazing.
We definitely notice that, too, in the little bit of sorghum that we've grown, what kind of production there is with that plant. And it seems like, oh, it's going to be short. Maybe there isn't going to be that much to it. But, no, it's a pretty substantial plant out there, too. Now, we're talking with Dan Atkinson down in Kansas. Dan, thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on, talking a little bit about sorghum. There's a lot of interest, and it sure is good to hear the trade is going so well that we've got a great market, too.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. Thanks a lot. Talking about sorghum and Milo production on today's program, and I think this is interesting too for growers who haven't raised those crops, planting in 30-inch rows, really treating it like your other row crops. That's been a good deal. But then just some of the other things like planting into no-till, making sure you get some residue out there, doing everything you can to conserve what moisture there is, and then you're planting a crop that is pretty tolerant of hot, dry conditions, seems to be a recipe for success. On today's program, we're also taking your calls and agronomic questions throughout at 844-44-AG-PHD. We'll dive back into more of those right after this.
Did you know soybean diseases like white mold and sudden death syndrome can survive in your soil even after rotating crops? Prevention of these diseases is a constant battle, and yield loss from an infection can be devastating. The right management plan makes all the difference. Keep your beans safe next spring with Heads Up Seed Treatment. Heads Up guards your seed treatment from both white mold and SDS. Stay protected and profitable by asking to have your seed pre-treated with Heads Up. Learn more at headsupst.com.
Are you combining around weed patches, waiting for weeds to dry down, or tired of spring burndown failures? Save time, nutrients, and moisture by including a Valor herbicide brand in your fall burndown program. Valor provides excellent residual control of tough weeds, including kochia, mare's tail, prickly lettuce, dandelion, plus suppression of bromes. Proactive, effective weed resistance management starts in the fall. Get a clean start for your next season with Valor Herbicide Brands. Always read and follow label directions.
We now bring you an important news bulletin.
This just in from Live Action News.
Innovation has come to the world of burndown.
New Elevore herbicide controls your toughest weeds, even glyphosate and ALS-resistant weeds like mare's tail and henbit. Talk with your retailer about Elevore herbicide today and ask how you can start elevating your burn down.
You deserve to have a building that will last for generations. With more than 110 years of experience and thousands of satisfied customers, Morton Buildings is the industry leader you can trust. Unlike other construction companies, you work with Morton Buildings craftsmen from conception to completion. There's no better time to buy. Lock in your new building for 2020 today. Contact your local Morton sales office or visit mortonbuildings.com.
The next big thing is here.
From the system that brought you Roundup Ready to Extend technology comes a soybean like no other. Introducing Extend Flex Soybeans. Elite genetics, now with the addition of glufosinate tolerance. Learn more at extendflexsoy.com. Always read and follow IRM where applicable, grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions. No dicamba may be used in crop with ExtendFlex soybeans unless and until approved, and no dicamba formulations are currently registered for such use in the 2021 season.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop, and grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us. We've been talking about milo or sorghum production, and certainly you could tell there's a lot of excitement about that crop with the way trade has been going right now. We were talking with Patrick Wade with the Texas Grain Sorghum Producers. He said we've already got $650 million worth of sales this year to China this year, and he said we were over $1 billion in 2015, and if we're continuing on this trend and we look at what the demand is, he sees a lot of optimism for sorghum growing this year. The prices right now are really excellent. Talking to quite a few growers in areas where sorghum is commonly grown, they're expanding acres, taking away some of the other crops just because the profit opportunity looks good for this year, which is fantastic. It's fun to have good choices where you can actually make some money. I got our friend Dell in Michigan on with us right now. Dell, how are you doing today?
Fine. You stole my thunder. I was going to ask you about harvesting because we don't really grow either up where I'm at. My neighbor grew it once when I was a boy, and I thought he chopped it for cows. Now, did he chop it after it was harvested? Like, you know, sometimes you bale corn stalks, and really like your show.
Yeah, you could do it either way. I know there's quite a bit of residue left. A lot of times they're running a row crop head and just, you know, taking the top portion of the plant, leaving most of that plant intact underneath. But you certainly could chop it and leave the grain in there like regular silage would go, or you could just chop up some of that residue that's underneath as well. We ended up having to wait harvesting ours until things froze. We just had a tough time getting the moisture out of it this year. It wasn't drying down as fast as we wanted to, and we caught a frost, and that certainly dried things out a lot quicker.
Yeah, our challenge has been for us in trying to raise this milo, it just doesn't dollar out as well as corn does, for us at least. Now, in different areas, the milo might end up being better. A lot of times we see it raised where moisture can be a little bit lacking, but we treat it kind of like we do corn. I mean, we've got to use N, P, and K. We will use a pre-emerge herbicide, usually consisting of a group 15, just like we would in corn. That'd be like Outlook, for example, Dual. And the only thing is, I would say that milo has to be treated. So we'll usually say concept treated milo. And then post-emerge, you can come with a low rate of dicamba. Husky is labeled. So Husky, that would be the same product that we would use in wheat, Husky. And that's got Bucktril in there that could be used in corn, and an HPPD. Now, we use HPPDs in corn. We just don't use that specific one that is labeled in Husky. And then for grass control, we'll use post-emerge Facet. There is a product called Paramount, and let's see, in lawns, you'd use the same active ingredient, and that would be Drive is the name brand product.
Quinclorac is the active ingredient
there
in those products.
You can also use Atrazine in milo. I guess you kind of have to look at a lot of the same things you do in corn. You got to scout for bugs. You might want to go out and spray for disease. But, you know, a lot of times people aren't doing that as much as they might in corn. Now, we don't have all the BT options. We don't have the Roundup Ready option and that kind of thing. So it is a little bit different. But yeah, there are a lot of people that will raise it successfully. And we raise some on our at our Ag PhD field day site over the last few years. So this year we decided we're going to put in a little field just for fun and just see how high we could get the yield. And everything was looking great until we missed out on rain for the last 3.5 months of the year, and it was not irrigated. So I think we still ended up with, was it 170, Darren, something like that, 165, 170. So, you know, for Milo, that's not too bad. But like I say, that the dollars aren't all that much different on a per bushel basis than what you're going to get for corn, or at least in our area. So for us, it really, we just say, well, we did it kind of for fun. It's probably not going to be our main crop here. We're going to continue probably in this area running corn and beans.
All right.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, let's dive into the Ag PhD mailbag again then.
Yeah. So Darren handed me this question early on in the show, and I've been racking my brain ever since. It's very interesting. We have someone who's got an acre where the soil got contaminated with mercury from past discharges of wastewater, and they had a couple of questions here. So the first one was, okay, they are worried because they want to graze this grass. And the question was, will we want to send some of this grass in for analysis to make sure that the amount isn't too high in the grass. And their question is, will we potentially lose any mercury present in the grass sample if we air dry and mill the sample following standard procedures? I got to be honest, I don't know that question. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know in terms of lab work. So Darren and I are agronomists, and we don't run into people trying to remediate heavy metals very often. But I will say, certainly when it's only 1 acre, now granted, 1 acre is, that's a lot, 43,560 square feet. So there are methods where you could literally take the soil and run it through. There are different things using, let's say, copper pellets, for example, to clean that and get the mercury back out of that, and then that mercury could be sold. There is certainly a market for mercury, and it's good. Otherwise, there are people that will talk about using plants. I know, there's smooth water hyssop and water hyansis that can suck up some mercury. So those are certainly some options. But here's the thing, and the reason why I wanted to talk about this in the radio a little bit is they said the mean concentration of mercury in the soil is about 50 parts per million. Okay, well, I'm going to assume that was a 6-inch soil test. So doing the math, we always take parts per million times 2 to get pounds per acre. Okay, 50 times 2 is 100. And I just looked at the heavy metals chart from the EPA, and the maximum amount, as long as your soil pH is 6.5 and above, I'm not sure what it is if it's 6.5 or below, but 6.5 and above, they say 15 pounds, that's the maximum legal limit, and we're talking 100 pounds. So to think that we're going to end up with grass grown there that would have too high a concentration to graze, I could absolutely believe that would be a problem, and now you're going to have that mercury getting into your livestock, and that could be a real issue. So I guess the only good thing I would say here is hopefully it is contained just to that 1 acre, but to think that we're going to be able to go graze that without having problems, I really would question that. So I apologize. I don't have all the answers. I am not the world's leading expert in this particular topic. But yeah, for anybody listening, if you've got soil that's contaminated with heavy metals, you really want to test that soil and see where you're at. If you're above the legal limits and you've got concerns about grazing and that kind of thing, then we would really encourage you talk to somebody who is an expert about remediation. Otherwise, you got to block that area off and not be grazing that.
Thanks for the question. We really appreciate that, though. Yeah, it's one that we don't normally hear from.
No,
no doubt about that. It's not our area of expertise.
And I would
happy
say,
to help if we can.
Yeah, and I would say let's just as farmers be thankful that we don't have to deal with some of these issues very often, because yeah, that's a tough one.
All right, get this one from Justin, and he said, I was wondering if you guys would be able to point me in the right direction. We're getting close to finishing up this year, and I'd like to go south to find work on a farm while our ground is frozen, really only need a couple of months like January and February. Where would you go if you had to go south to find a job on a farm to get into some warm weather.
Well, let's put it this way. There are a lot of people hiring, so you just have to start looking around. I mean, my first thought is, obviously, it's got to be somewhere where they're still raising crops. So right away, I'm thinking Florida, South Texas, and out in California. Maybe even Southern Arizona as well.
Yeah, I think so, too. And the great thing now is we're all so connected with all the online options that you've got to find places. I bet you'll find something. And yeah, if your goal is just to get to some warm weather, that's cool. But here's the other thing. Let's just say that you're raising whatever crop on your farm. Find something that you can learn about. Maybe it's, well, hey, I want to learn about some different crops, or I wanted to learn about some grass crops or some broadleaf crops or some vegetable crops. You may find an area of interest that could actually help your farm as well, in addition to getting paid and spending a couple months where it's warm. That would be great too. Well, hey, thanks for the question, Justin. We appreciate that. We'll dive right back into the Ag PhD mailbag after this.
We now bring you an important news bulletin.
This just in from Live Action News.
Innovation has come to the world of burndown.
New Elevore herbicide controls your toughest weeds, even glyphosate and ALS-resistant weeds like mare's tail and henbit. Talk with your retailer about Elevore herbicide today and ask how you can start elevating your burndown.
You would never plant seed or apply herbicide with a 20% success rate. So why are you still applying phosphorus fertilizer with a maximum availability of only 20%? Double your phosphate availability and increase yields with NutriCharge from AgroTech USA. NutriCharge's patent-pending technology protects phosphorus from negative chemical reactions that tie up your fertilizer investment. NutriCharge performs across all soil types and pHs. Contact AgroTech USA or your local Van Deese supply representative today.
Heat, drought, wind, hail, northern corn leaf blight, gray leaf spot. If your corn is under stress, you are too. Get Veltima fungicide, swift activity, with fast payback, an expanded application window. Makes life simple, and it's the secure choice. With powerful residual for visibly healthier corn. Swift, simple, secure. Veltima fungicide. Call your BASF rep today. Always read and follow label directions. Veltima fungicide is not registered in all states.
When it comes to commanding herbicide formulations, you know Nufarm. Nufarm brings you Panther SC, an animal when it comes to speed of control and long residual on a broad spectrum of tough broadleaf weeds like mare's tail, Palmer amaranth, and water hemp. And did we mention convenience? Panther SC works in pre-plant, pre-emerge, and post-harvest systems and keeps your rotation options open. Nufarm and Panther SC, here to help.
It's about time. Applied at Planting, new Xyway 3D fungicide from FMC delivers foliar disease protection from planting to harvest. Active ingredient flutriafol moves from the soil through the corn as it grows for inside-out protection from roots to tassel. For season-long protection, choose first-of-its-kind Enfuro Xyway 3D fungicide. To learn more, call 815-362-7747 today. Always read and follow all label directions.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Back, you're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Our phone lines are open throughout the rest of the show at 844-44-AG-PHD if you've got an agronomic question. Got this one from Diego in Argentina. He said, I wanted to talk to you guys about soybean herbicides. I'm wondering which ones I am safe to till in. In Argentina, in this area anyway, we don't do that. We don't till in our herbicides. But we're going to double crop our soybeans next week, and I'm going with your 3-pre strategy. I don't see rain in the near forecast, so thinking this sounds like it may be the best idea. I'm going to try to make it up to the Ag PhD field day someday and meet you guys. Hey, thanks a lot, Diego. Really appreciate that.
Okay, so most everything can get lightly tilled in. The problem that we end up with is if you bury stuff. So we want to keep it as shallow as possible. If you're doing light tillage, now you get the herbicide down in the ground a little bit. And a lot of times we'll say you'll get the herbicide in roughly half the depth of your tillage. So if you till at 4 inches, the herbicide's at 2 inches. You till at 3 inches, the herbicide's at an inch and a half. So we want that concentration preferably in the top inch as much as we can. So yeah, you gotta, here's what I usually tell people, drive really fast. So if you're using a machine with some sweeps, we call those field cultivators up here, that's what we run, and then we'll have maybe a harrow in the back or rolling baskets, something like that. But anyway, the point is, we want to run maybe 7 or 8 miles an hour with a big machine. So we're going fast. That way I know you can't bury it. And the issue that we have a lot of times is guys will say, well, I want to run a little slower and I want to run a little deeper, so I cover my wheel tracks. So what we do, what we suggest is you put extensions on your shanks that are going to run behind the wheels. So that way, basically, my point is those shanks are set down just a little bit deeper so you can get your wheel tracks covered, and then the rest of the machine is running more shallow. So when you do something like that, typically it does work pretty well. It does require less rainfall for activation. And I'll just leave you with this one last thought. Anything new that we do on the farm, we are going to typically suggest you only do it on a few acres. So if nobody tills, you've never done it, you've never even tried this before, just do it on a few acres. See what happens. You're going to learn something. You always learn something the first time you do it. And I hate to say it, but farming is a lot about trial and error. And I'd way rather have you try it on a few acres, because there's probably going to be something that you're going to learn and something that's going to get, you know, might not be perfect. So just do it on a few acres so you don't take a lot of risk.
All right. Thanks a lot, Diego. Really appreciate that. Good luck to you. You can certainly send us more questions again if they come up. Got this one from Dane in Central Illinois, who's just getting started farming. He said, I purchased 2 tracts of land late last spring, and they both need some large improvements. Looking for recommendations where to start. The ground was previously rented. Soil pH is in the 4s. Base saturation calcium in the 40s. Base saturation potassium under 2. Now, I was unable to get lime spread before or last year, but I will be spreading ag lime hopefully this week. And I would also like to bring base saturation K up before spring. I plan on incorporating the lime and then drilling some cereal rye. I transition to no-till. Can I apply 3 tons of lime and 400 pounds of potash before incorporating? I'm coming out of corn. I'm going into beans. All right, Wait.
What did you say was in the 40s?
Base saturation calcium.
Oh, calcium. Yeah. Okay, and what was his question there again?
Well, he wants to put on lime, and he's wondering if he can also put on 400 pounds of potash at the same time and then incorporate them in the ground. Now, here's the other thing, Dane. I see that we've got about 5 soil samples, and one of the things that if your pH is 4 all over, then I'm not super worried about it, but my guess is that pH is going to vary a little bit throughout the field. And when we've done smaller grid sizes, we've been able to narrow down where we need to adjust pH and where we don't, because if you're going to bring that base saturation calcium way up, that's wonderful where it's 40. But if it already is 60 and you're going to bring it way up, you're going to run into some troubles.
Yeah, and he's got one that's the base saturation calcium 75. Actually, his soil test is almost perfect other than the low K in this one spot, 6.5 pH. So, I mean, a lot of things are great here.
I see this soil sample, and here's one too, that one I can see the first line there is a 4.9 pH.
Yeah.
So I know there's some spots out there that definitely need it, but it may not be exactly what you think. I kind of had the same thing. I had some rented ground that was run down that I bought, and I did some large grid samples, but then also did some small grid samples, and I found that where I thought I needed the lime, it wasn't exactly where it ended up being. I ended up having a few spots throughout the field that really needed the lime.
Oh, okay. So when you asked the question, I thought, and I misunderstood, I thought you said, can I put the lime and the potash together? No, that's not going to work. You got different bulk densities, I'm almost sure. But can you go spread the 3 tons of lime and then go spread the 400 pounds of potash? Absolutely. We're doing some of that on our own farm right now. So no problem at all. Just go ahead and do that. And this is mostly medium textured soil, by the way. So when we start talking about low base saturation potassium in a super heavy soil, it takes a lot of pounds to correct that. When you're in a medium textured soil, it doesn't take all that much, and you're going to be certainly headed the right direction.
All right. Thanks for the questions. Really appreciate that, Dana. Good luck to you as you get started farming. Okay, got some samples here from Tom in Colorado, and this is flood irrigated ground that he's trying to fix up. He said not a big field here. It's kind of a small field, but he said I'm working to improve this one. We've taken out the flood irrigation system. We're going with some big gun sprinklers. That seems to be much more consistent. We're putting in a mixture of pasture grass and alfalfa, and this year we got 1,200 small bales off it. We sent samples in to see what the recommendations would be, and this is what they sent us back. They're recommending we put on 20 pounds of nitrogen. That's it. What would you do based on these soil sample results?
Okay, let's see. I was just looking for how heavy this ground is. Did you happen to see cation exchange capacity on here anywhere, Darren? I did not. No, so I don't know how heavy the ground is. And part of the reason why I'm asking this is you need more potassium. You're really low on potassium in some spots. You got 98 parts per million. That's just not enough. And, I mean, when you start talking about grass and alfalfa, you're going to cut it and take that off. You need those potassium levels higher. So, for example, there's one spot where it's 981 parts per million. Okay, now we're talking. But when you're clear down to 98 parts per million, you need a lot of potassium. So anyway, I asked about the basically how heavy that soil is, because potassium doesn't move very well into heavy soils. But if it's light soil, then it will move fairly well with irrigation and or rainfall. So yeah, if it's me, I'm absolutely getting some more potassium out there, but it's unfortunate because it's not going to move super well. Let's step back though. Next time, before you seed in an alfalfa crop or hay crop or combination, alfalfa and grass, whatever, I'd put on a lot of P and K onto your ground and get it down into the ground where the crop needs it, because that's your one shot. Phosphorus barely moves in soil. I'm also looking at your zinc levels that are very low, and you got some low phosphorus too. You can't fix that really now. You can try. You can put some stuff out there, but at best, it's going to get an inch deep over the next few years. So it's not great. But yeah, we're real low in some spots. I mean, we're down to 15 parts per million on phosphorus and 1.4 parts per million on zinc. So both are real low in areas. So yeah, those are a couple of the things that I would look at. The other thing would be maybe just adding a little bit of boron. We know that alfalfa is very responsive to boron, and your boron levels are very deficient. So I would try a little bit of that. I might try just a little bit of sulfur. Can't get too carried away. But yeah, then certainly some nitrogen for that grass crop.
Right. Thanks for the questions. We appreciate that. Got this one from Matt, and he said, I farm in Northwest Iowa, mostly sandy soil, CECs 10 or less. On a recent episode, you were talking about drought-proofing your soils. Wondering if you found this helps on light sandy soils as well and improving the soil's water-holding capacity for dry years.
Okay. We probably don't spend enough time talking about the sand and the drought-proofing, so here are some things that I would work on. Number one, I would very much reduce my tillage. Number two, I'd be trying to build soil organic matter, and that kind of goes along with the reducing tillage thing. And then three, I would look at getting my magnesium up. Very often in sandy soil, we see magnesium deficient. We want that magnesium up near 20% on a base saturation test. The more magnesium you have out there, the more you kind of tighten that light soil. But yeah, we want to have a good blend of nutrients. We want to have good drainage, just like we always do. I mean, so a lot of the same things we'll talk about in heavy soil, we'll talk about in sandy soil. But I mean, I'd really stress the reducing tillage and building organic matter.
Matt also commented they made a trip out to the Black Hills mid-August this year. They knew we were really dry, but they swung by our farm and were really impressed with how well the crop looked in the dry conditions. Hey, thanks, Matt. We appreciate that. We were kind of impressed as well that it looked as good as it did, as dry as we got. Thanks for listening to our show today. Be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio.